Welcome to Wild Tracker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 21st episode. Wild Tracker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Tracker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This is the fourth episode of a seven-part series I call Dream World. This episode is devoted to writing about nature. Tropical rainforest of French Guiana, I have the impression of being a total stranger, threading my way through the dark forest. Everything looms over me on such a gigantic scale. The canopies of broad-leafed trees are shrouded in wisps of mist high above. Even the ferns tower over me. I hear all kinds of creepy, crawly animals around me and buzzing insects. Then I stop, spellbound. What is that? A musician wren, one of the most enchanting birds of South America. This music is utterly beyond anything I could ever perform on my own. It's like an appeal to the Wild Tracker, the ancient, half-forgotten, green man lying hidden within me. Right from the start, the minute we humans represent nature, we delve into storytelling. We project ourselves onto natural phenomena. I believe what we observe is conditioned very much by our native surroundings. For example, one of the first great nature writers was Gilbert White, an English curate living in the parish of Selborne, East Hampshire, in the 18th century. His native environment consisted of chalk downlands, gardens, orchards, fields marked out with thick hedgerows, groves of beechwood, oak, and hawthorn. Gilbert White observed the humble animals in this environment: hedgehogs, field mice, land tortoises, bees, sparrows, and swifts. Hedgehogs abound in my gardens and fields. The manner in which they eat their roots of the plantain in my grass walks is very curious. With their upper mandible, which is much longer than their lower, they bore under the plant, and so eat the root off upwards, leaving the tuft of leaves untouched. In this respect, they are serviceable, as they destroy a very troublesome weed, but they deface the wattles in some measure by digging little round holes. It appears, by the dung that they drop onto the turf, that beetles are no inconsiderable part of their food. I find Gilbert White's nature observations interesting, but he's mostly writing about a country, England, whose wilderness disappeared long ago. His nature seems thoroughly domesticated. Over the course of prehistory and history, humans have gone through several phases in our relationship with nature. I would like to mention a first, prehistoric kind of representation of nature, which goes back a very long way. I remember my mother telling me once how she'd gone to Altamira in northern Spain, where she had seen Stone Age cave paintings going back some 17,000 years, to a time when animals had still not been domesticated, and most of Canada was covered with an ice sheet a few kilometers thick. These remarkable cave paintings in red, black, and violet show life-size bison, horses, boars, red deer, handprints, and geometric shapes. These representations are lifelike. Their meaning is not clear to us. Were they pedagogical tools painted to educate young people about hunting? Were they sacred works, part of a ritual? Were they artworks designed to give pleasure to the eye? Whatever the case, I believe that the prehistoric people of Altamira, whose existence depended on hunting and gathering, saw the world from within nature. They must have had some kind of ecological conscience. They knew the bounty of nature had its limits. They knew that humans were one species among many. Humans shared the natural world with other species. I would like to mention a second historic kind of representation of nature, going back to the pre-Socratic philosophers of ancient Greece. In the 5th century BC, they began to treat nature not as something shared, but as an abstraction, something out there which can be observed, measured, investigated, and systematized using logos, which means reason and judgment. The Greek philosopher Protagoras claimed man is the measure of all things. Now, he likely meant truth is in the eye of the beholder and is therefore relative to each person. But his famous remark also implies that all life on this planet swirls around humans. Around the same time, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus wrote a work called On Nature. This work started with a discourse on the universe, then continued with a discourse on politics, and concluded with a discourse on theology. Unfortunately, this work has not survived, but many ancient philosophers paraphrased fragments from it. Heraclitus created the concept of nature. He treated nature, or physis, as a kind of abstraction, which can be studied using reason. It can be broken down into components. It can be articulated to form a complete system or order called the cosmos. So we've already moved from humans at Altamira being within nature to humans in the ancient Greek world treating nature as an abstraction on the human scale, an abstraction worthy of investigation. I would like to mention here the third historic kind of representation. Nature, according to this religious view, is actually God's nature. In the Jewish and Christian context, all things are the way they are because that's the way God created them and intended them to be. We have only to think of the 95th Psalm, which reads, "The Lord is a great God, and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, for his hands formed the dry land." So God has created the world and every living thing that moves through the air and across the land and waters. As we read in the book of Genesis, God has established a hierarchy with humans as his favorite species, then other animals below that. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." The Bible tells us God can intervene in nature at any time, turning water to blood, bringing plagues of frogs, lice, and insects upon the people, striking their livestock with pestilence, stirring up storms of hail and locusts, bringing on catastrophic floods. God watches over his creation at all times. This is why I feel strange when speaking to extremely religious people who attribute freakish weather and northern lights and epidemics to the hand of God, as if God intervened directly at the local level in order to reward or punish humans for their behavior. It isn't that surprising that the extremely religious should do so, because the Bible is full of fantastic demons, monsters, sea dragons, awful beasts with seven heads, horrid faces emerging from swirling clouds of fire, fallen giants, and supernatural presences. In the 4th century BC, the Greek philosopher Aristotle developed a philosophical god which bears comparison to the Jewish and Christian god. As Aristotle says in the Metaphysics, "We hold then that God is a living being, eternal, most good, and therefore life and a continuous eternal existence belong to God, for that is what God is." Since Aristotle portrayed God as being the unmoved mover or primary cause of all motion in the universe, God also moves all living beings towards their natural purpose. Aristotle even holds, in the Politics, nature does nothing without purpose or uselessly. Aristotle changed the way people perceive nature. All of nature bears the imprint of intelligent design. The objective of the natural investigator is to seek out the purpose of every phenomenon rather than the cause from which it arises. Such natural investigations are therefore undertaken to discover God's intentions. Aristotle's philosophy of nature proved compatible with the God of Judaism and Christianity, and indeed Islam, and would dominate the Western world for close to 2,000 years. I would like to mention here that extremely religious people have sometimes imagined natural settings to flesh out or illustrate their religious beliefs. For example, the island of Vulcano in the Aeolian Islands just north of Sicily was considered to be the mouth of hell in antiquity, the place where the Greek smith god Hephaestus forged iron tools. Hephaestus also had a workshop inside the larger volcano, Mount Etna, on the island of Sicily. Here it was that Hephaestus made the iron net he used to entrap his faithless wife Aphrodite and her lover Ares and drag them to the top of Mount Olympus, casting them in ridicule before Zeus. Picking up where the Greeks left off, the Romans gave a new name to Hephaestus, calling him Vulcan and giving him responsibility for fire, metallurgy, sculptors, volcanoes, artisans, and technology. Here it was, they claimed, that Vulcan forged the thunderbolts of Jupiter, and Jupiter is the Roman name for Zeus. Writing in the 7th century AD, Adamnan of Iona, an Irish abbot, describes Vulcano as the gate of hell, which he contrasts with Jerusalem, the gate of heaven. So there's a kind of fearful symmetry in these two places when taken together. According to Adamnan, apparently echoing the 6th century Pope St. Gregory the Great, Vulcano thunders continuously, the crater blazing with fire by night and belching forth smoke by day, although the volcano is more active on Fridays and Saturdays, recalling the suffering and death of Jesus Christ just before the resurrection. Volcano is an actual mountain, 501 meters or 1,644 feet tall, not far from Lipari. When I was there recently, I looked down into the fuming crater from the summit, but I couldn't quite make out the gate to hell. One of the weirdest works on nature ever written was published in 1588. It's the work of the great astronomer, physician, and engineer, Galileo Galilei. In this work, he seeks to establish, investigate, measure, and systematize the physical features of hell, or more precisely, the Inferno in Dante Alighieri's early 14th century poem, The Divine Comedy. This amounts to applying reason and judgment to Dante's projection of an imagined natural environment consistent with a hodgepodge of traditions in the Bible and classical antiquity. For example, Galileo writes that the forest where Dante meets Virgil was between Cuma and Naples, and here was the entrance to the Inferno. And we may reasonably suppose it to be here, first, because the circle of the mouth of the Inferno passes precisely by Naples. Second, because in this region, or not very far from it, are Lake Averno, the mountains Drago, Acheron, Lipari, Mongibello, and similar other places, which by the horrible effects they produce, deserve to be considered infernal places. And finally, one may suppose the poet to have imagined the entrance to the Inferno there to imitate Virgil, his escort, who put it in such a place. So having arrived at the gate of the entrance, over which were written in dark colors the words, "Through me you enter into the city of woes. Through me you enter into eternal pain. Through me you enter the population of loss." They begin to descend by a slope until they arrive at the grotto of the uncommitted, hateful to God and to his enemies. This grotto is a most ample cavern, placed between the surface of the earth and the edge of the Inferno, just like those who dwell there, banned from heaven and from the abyss. Here they find those unfortunate ones running behind a banner. Following then their descent, they arrive at the river Acheron. This river passes around the first circle of the Inferno, which is Limbo, and here they find the demon Charon, who ferries the souls in his great boat to the other bank. In this place, because of the shaking of the earth and the flash of red light, the poet fainted, and then, reawakened by a great thunderclap, he found himself on the other bank. Walking then, he comes to the path of the first circle, and having entered, together with Virgil, into limbo, he turns, walking to the right, and sees the innocent babies who died without baptism, and those who lived morally but without the Christian faith, who have no other torment there than that they may not have the vision of God. In this circle they find the ardent flame and the noble castle, surrounded by seven circuits of walls. This circle is distant from the surface of the earth by 1/8 the radius, that is, close to 406 miles, and its width is 87.5 miles. Having circled the 10th part of this, they go down to the second, smaller and lower, where, under Minos, judge of the damned, the hosts of the sensuous are punished by continual buffeting. And the distance of this circle to the first is as much as the distance of the first to the surface of the earth, that is, close to 406 miles, and it is 75 miles wide. Having circled the 10th part of this, they go down to the third, distant similarly from the second by close to 406 miles, and 62.5 miles wide, where the gluttonous under Cerberus are afflicted by continuous rain and hail. Well, Galileo then goes on to infer from Dante's Inferno that Lucifer, that is, the devil, protrudes out of vast ice regions in the depths of hell and is 1,935 braccia tall. This means the devil's height would come to 1,270 of our meters nowadays, or 4,193 feet. Time to get back to nature. Riding on horseback in the Rockies of Alberta in Western Canada, it's a crisp evening in the autumn. We're about to reach our camp for the night. There's one last stream to ford, and then we hear it. The strange shrieking and whistling and bugling of bull elk. Our horses stop and listen. I always feel, in moments like this, especially when night is falling, a deep bond with nature. We humans like to bond with nature. Or maybe we only feel we bond with nature, because the idea of bonding implies a two-way relationship. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the verb bond means to join securely to something else. It also means to establish a relationship or link with someone based on shared feelings, interests, or experiences. When bull elk whistle, they're announcing where they are and trying to locate other bulls. They don't whistle in order to bond with humans. If these elk saw me, they would only have seen an oddly dressed human sitting on the back of a bay horse with a black mane. Probably they would have been more interested in the horse than in me. I would like to come now to a fourth historic kind of representation of nature, which is closely related to fear. For several centuries now, fear has been associated with voluntarily exposing oneself to extreme danger the sublime and the quest for absolutes in a world forsaken by God. Overcoming fear is the driving force of many of our experiences. To overcome fear, you need first to name it, which is a way of taming it, then face it, forming an idea of the risks involved, then defy it, but you need, above all, to get home safely. While making my feature film, The Blinding Sea, I shot footage of people and animals interacting in awe-inspiring landscapes in the Arctic and Antarctic. At one point, the wind chill when I was filming got down to minus 68.3 centigrade, or minus 91 degrees Fahrenheit. No wonder my camera and my fingers froze. In the film, I use visuals that fall under the genre of the polar sublime. The polar regions sometimes remind me of the Sahara Desert. Cold and hot deserts, featureless dunes rolling along out to the horizon, have that same quality of emptiness. You lay yourself bare, and you come up so close to nothingness that it envelops you. My life experience and the film have got me thinking about the difference between the sublime and the beautiful. This was a subject of interest to 18th century philosophers. For example, in 1757, the British philosopher Edmund Burke wrote, "A philosophical inquiry into the origins of our ideas of the sublime and beautiful." In this work, he states, "Whatever is fitted, in any sort, to excite the ideas of pain and danger, that is to say, whatever is in any sort terrible, or is conversant about terrible subjects, or operates in a manner analogous to terror, is a source of the sublime. That is, it is productive of the strongest emotion which the mind is capable of feeling. I say the strongest emotion because I'm satisfied the ideas of pain are much more powerful than those which enter on the part of pleasure." And a little later on in the same work, Burke states, "No passion so effectually robs the mind of all its powers of acting and reasoning as fear. For fear, being an apprehension of pain or death, it operates in a manner that resembles actual pain. Whatever therefore is terrible with regard to sight is sublime too, whether this cause of terror be endued with greatness of dimensions or not. For it is impossible to look on anything as trifling or contemptible that may be dangerous. There are many animals who, though far from being large, are yet capable of raising ideas of the sublime because they are considered as objects of terror, as serpents and poisonous animals of almost all kinds. And to things of great dimensions, if we annex an adventitious idea of terror, they become without comparison greater. A level plain of a vast extent on land is certainly no mean idea. The prospect of such a plain may be as extensive as a prospect of the ocean, but can it ever fill the mind with anything so great as the ocean itself? This is owing to several causes, but it is owing to none more than this, that the ocean is an object of no small terror. Indeed, terror is, in all cases whatsoever, either more openly or latently, the ruling principle of the sublime." Burke notes that the beautiful, on the other hand, operates at quite a different emotional level. "We shall have a strong desire for a woman of no remarkable beauty, whilst the greatest beauty in men or in other animals, though it causes love, yet excites nothing at all of desire. Which shows that beauty and the passion caused by beauty, which I call love, is different from desire, though desire may sometimes operate along with it. But it is to this latter that we must attribute those violent and tempestuous passions, and the consequent emotions of the body which attend what is called love, in some of its ordinary acceptations, and not to the effects of beauty merely as it is such. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote Observations on the Feeling of the Beautiful and Sublime in 1764. The sublime moves, the beautiful charms. The mien of a man who's undergoing the full feeling of the sublime is earnest, sometimes rigid, and astonished. On the other hand, the lively sensation of the beautiful proclaims itself through shining cheerfulness in the eyes, through smiling features, and often through audible mirth. The sublime is in turn of different kinds. Its feeling is sometimes accompanied with a certain dread or melancholy, in some cases merely with quiet wonder, and in still others with a beauty completely pervading a sublime plan. The first I shall call the terrifying sublime, the second the noble, and the third the splendid. Deep loneliness is sublime, but in a way that stirs terror. Hence great far-reaching solitudes like the colossal Komul desert in Tartary have always given us occasion for peopling them with fearsome spirits. By the way, the Komul desert mentioned by Kant seems to be the modern-day Taklamakan desert of northwest China. Is there any psychological or aesthetic reason for this fascination with the sublime? If Kant is right, then fascination with the sublime, the terrorizing and the dreadful, may be a melancholy sort of obsession. But then I'm not a melancholy person. I believe the fascination with the sublime is sometimes part of a quest for absolutes in a world forsaken by God. You voluntarily expose yourself to extreme dangers and experience the thrilling adrenaline rush of facing the vast expanse of the wilderness. You realize you are utterly vulnerable and insignificant against the backdrop of hurricanes at sea and looming glaciers and jagged mountain ranges. You step right up to the very edge of nothingness, but then, hopefully, you stand back from fear and return home to your normal occupations. This is what gives such extraordinary power to Robert Falcon Scott's evocations of nature in the books he wrote about the Discovery and Terra Nova expeditions to the Antarctic. They are sublime and even romantic to the point of being heroic. Scott was, by all accounts, a melancholy person. Fear is to be found in many kinds of storytelling. Journeys through fear are one of the great themes of art, from Orpheus to Dante, and war reporting to exploration narratives. I learned, while making the feature film The Blinding Sea, that polar explorers a century and more ago felt compelled to return over and again to the polar regions so they could defy death and melt into the pure whiteness, the utter stillness of the frozen land and sea. They were irresistibly drawn back to the polar theater so they could feel the thrill of fear and use that fear as a springboard to achievement. Getting home safely may have been a secondary concern. Before closing, I would like to mention a few last kinds of representation of nature. A fifth historic kind of representation is the system of nature, as studied in modern biology. The investigator no longer seeks to uncover God's secret intentions or the intelligent design of all species of fauna and flora. The investigator now sees nature in a new light, as a tremendous life force, constantly inventing new adaptations, new variations, with each species struggling to reproduce and survive. All life as we know it is interrelated, interconnected, simply because all life has evolved from a common source organism ages upon ages ago. A sixth historic kind of representation shows nature as something vertical, with humans at the top of a hierarchy of life, poised to exploit, transform, reorder, and re-engineer nature as we see fit. A seventh and final historic kind of representation of nature is what I would call anti-nature. It thrusts humans into highly polluted urban environments where we are exiled or alienated from the natural world and we are artificially sustained. When I look at the impact of the current pandemic in the world, it seems humanity itself is on life support, hoping against hope for a vaccine that will eradicate the coronavirus. Yet the human destruction of the environment, the sheer burden of toxic pollution, makes us more vulnerable to disease. Each person has his or her own native surroundings. What are your native surroundings like? I'm used most of all to great immersive forests in the Appalachian Mountains of southern Quebec, mixed forests of maple and pine and spruce and cedar, opening here and there onto dark blue lakes. Bears and lynxes and white-tailed deer and loons and brook trout and deer flies abound in this environment. There's so much to see. And so much that cannot be seen. And when I say immersive, I mean that in the rolling granite hills of Appalachia, I don't feel outside of nature, observing it as if I were a stranger. I'm very much a part of this nature. The species in this native environment are still wild, they're wary of humans, and no words of ours can domesticate them. In fact, by writing about wild animals, we're mostly projecting ourselves onto them. And it is we who are thoroughly domesticated. We've moved along in this podcast from humans within nature, to humans treating nature as an abstraction on the human scale, to God's nature, where everything is perfectly designed and has a purpose. And from there we've moved along to sublime, God-forsaken nature, which arouses fear, dread, and terror. And from there to systems of nature, vertical nature, and finally, anti-nature. Life has taught me to see nature as a world of being that we share with countless other species. To really share, though, we need to recover the wild trekker, the ancient, half-forgotten green man or woman lying hidden within us. Well, that's it for this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of this series of podcasts I call Dream World. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net, and Evidencia is spelt with an N, as in November. By the way, I heard a musician wren in the jungle of French Guiana a few years ago, but the actual recording was made by Fernando Igor de Godoy on the upper Amazon, not too far from the Peruvian border. The precise location was on the Purus River, Boca do Acre, state of Amazonas, Brazil. You can find this recording on the following website, xeno-canto.org. That's xeno, X-E-N-O, dash, canto, C-A-N-T-O, .org. The recording is part of a series called Fonoteca Casa da Florest, and it has been given the following number, FCF-01672. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeux on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.